Hey, 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 this is First Ghost Connect. I'm Al Letson, sitting in the big chair, coming to you live from Studio 2 at WJCT. Today, an inside look at Hispanic Heritage Month and how you can join the celebration, plus Starlight Gala and Achieving the Dream Scholarship. But first, Hispanic Heritage Month kicks off September 15th, and it's a nationwide celebration honoring the many achievements, histories, and cultures of Hispanic and Latino Americans. We've invited community members from around the First Coast to talk about Hispanic heritage and some of the events that they are curating. So let's give a warm welcome to Monica Hernandez, president of the First Coast Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. Good morning, Monica.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Attorney Elizabeth Ruiz, managing a partner at Ruiz Law and Accident and Immigration Attorneys of Jacksonville. Ms. Ruiz, how are you?
Doing well. Thank you for having me today.
And just to be clear, like, we're calling you Lisa because Lisa's what everybody calls you, right?
That's my nickname.
All right. That's your nickname. Okay. I don't want people to be like, you said she was Elizabeth. We're just getting it right. Then we've got Eric Garcia, treasurer of First Coast Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. Eric, how are you, sir?
Doing well. Good morning. Buenos dias, everyone.
All right. And Dr. Rebecca Dominguez Carmini, an oral historian and founder of, you know what, I'm going to let you say the organization that you founded.
Okay. I founded Voces Hispanas, and it's an oral history collection.
That is amazing.
Thank you for having me.
I would have totally butchered it, so that's why I give it to you. But oral histories are my jam, so I can't wait to talk a little bit more about that. Listen, listeners, you can join the conversation. Call us at 549-2937. You can tweet us at FCC On Air. You can email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org or message us on the First Coast Connect Facebook page or Instagram. So I'll just open this up to the panel. Actually, I'll start off with you, Monica. So what exactly is Hispanic Heritage Month?
So Hispanic Heritage Month really was started in 1968 as Hispanic Heritage Week, as a way to celebrate the history, the culture, and the contributions of American Hispanics in the United States. And then in 1988, it actually transitioned to a full month from September 15th through October 15th, which is today what we celebrate. And, you know, people always wonder and tell me, like, why is it like from mid-September to October 15th? And it's really because during that month or that transition period is where you're going to have the independence of many Latin American countries. So we're going to have Costa Rica, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Nicaragua, and then Mexico and Chile celebrate their independence on September 16th and the 18th, respectively. And then on Columbus Day, or Día de la Raza, which is on October 12th, falls within that same, you know, 30-day period. So it does have a reason as to why it's from September 15th through October 15th. But really, I always like to highlight it and recognize that really we just utilize that time to make sure that we are celebrating the diversity that we have within our culture, within our, you know, ethnicity, because really being Latino, being Hispanic is an ethnicity, it's not a race. Therefore, we look different, we think different. I mean, all of us here, we are completely different, yet we're all Hispanic and or Latinos.
Yeah, I was about to ask you about that, because as you are naming off all the different countries that have Independence Day is coming up, that, you know, when we talk about Hispanic heritage and Hispanic culture, it's not a monolith. Like, there are so many different types of Latinos and countries and all of that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So if you think of the term Hispanic, really is just. It's a way of identifying a whole community, right? We sort of all got lumped into this box where, you know, if you want to put one community into a box, it is Hispanic, right? And it is a community that is of Spanish, the language, you know, they speak Spanish. However, we're different, right? I have friends that are Hispanic, that are Latinos, but they're Asian, right? Mm-hmm. Their heritage, their parents are from Asia, or you have indigenous people that are equally Latinos, that are equally Hispanics. You have African descent individuals that are also Latinos, and it's equally, right? It's all about the ethnicity in the country where you're from.
I want to open it up to the panel a little bit more and just ask, talk to me a little bit about the Hispanic culture in Jacksonville and the First Coast.
I can definitely say that it's grown over the past 10 years. Duval County, St. Johns County, and Clay County have all tremendously increased according to our Census Bureau. So the amount of Hispanics moving to the area, starting their own businesses, has definitely grown over the past 10 years.
Elizabeth, can you tell us some of the struggles that this growing community has in Jacksonville?
Well, I think the challenges that we face are very similar to the ones that are faced by Hispanics on a national level, and immigration reform being one of the top challenges that we face right now. And then I know that there are also challenges to accessing healthcare and others that have been affected by recent changes in state law.
I was having lunch with a friend of mine who is Latino, and when we were talking about this subject, he said, like, you know, you just need to make sure that everybody knows it's way more than just tacos and tequila. It's a lot deeper than that. It's a very rich history, and I just wanted to dive into that a little bit. So Dr. Dominguez Carmini, can you shed some light on that?
Well, as Monica referred to, all of the Hispanics, we're all different, and of course our histories are all different. We come from different parts of the world, and I think that, I hate to use this word, but I'm going to use it, that diversity that exists is very palpable in our population, and we're just all very different.
I think that we, even in this room, represent different countries and mm-hmm. backgrounds. For example, my dad is from Peru. He came here to the United States in the 70s, and he after he married my mom, who is of white Anglo-Saxon Protestant descent, native Floridian. I grew up in a very rich cultural background that comprised of the food and the different, you know, the Spanish language. But yet at the same time, on my mom's side, there's rich culture that derives from here, Southern culture. An interesting fact is that on my maternal grandmother's side, one of our ancestors was the founder of Nashville and was a general in the Confederate Army. Wow. So I've had the chance to grow up as an American, born and raised here, but at the same time, exposed to cultures from different, you know, parts of the world, and especially Peru.
And Monica, you're the president of the First Coast Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. Can you tell me a little bit about what the Chamber of Commerce does?
Absolutely. So as an organization, we represent all nationalities, right? So even our events are highlighted and are inclusive of all the different countries in Latin America and the Caribbean. So as an organization, really, we focus in advocating for Hispanic business owners, for entrepreneurs, for creating connections that are ultimately going to improve the betterment of the Hispanic business community. We also work closely with other organizations within the city that can ultimately provide more opportunity for business owners that can represent, that we can advocate. So for instance, you know, as I started with the chamber, one of the main focuses that I have was to be able to find, get programming that is bilingual for, you know, for the entrepreneurs. So for instance, you know, working with the SBDC, as the SBDC is providing training courses and programs for the Hispanic community, they now have a bilingual speaker that is ultimately being able to meet with entrepreneurs, with individuals that are starting to open businesses that are, you know, as the fastest growing minority, that is what's happening, right? They are opening, we are opening businesses at a faster rate than any other community. Being able to work with JSAP, that now they also have a representative that speaks Spanish, that is ultimately allowing a business owner to learn in their language. I always jokingly say, you know, it's very difficult to learn math in a different language, right? Let alone to understand the tax code in a language that's not yours. It's not about a handout, it's about opportunity, right? It's about having the opportunity to learn, to be able to have the ability to ask the questions in Spanish, even if, you know, even if the program is in English. So, you know, I think it was last year that we hosted a 2-day federal series event where we had individuals from the city come in and speak about the various programming that are available, how to, you know, how to gain an access to contracts within the city. And even though the speech, you know, some of the speakers were not bilingual, we were there. We were able to have somebody from the SBA that was bilingual. That way, if anybody wanted to ask questions in Spanish, it was an option, right? I personally moved to the U.S. 24 years ago. I had to learn the language from the bottom, right? I only knew the colors and the numbers at the time. So I understand, right? I still do math in Spanish. I still do certain things in Spanish because that is my first language. So I fully understand, you know, what it means. And I've seen it. I've seen the struggle through my mom, right? Through the lens of my mom, mm-hmm. where, you know, creating a business plan, understanding how to gain access to capital. And that is actually one of the largest and biggest limitations, you know, that are impacting business owners, minority owned businesses, is gaining access to capital.
Yeah, I would imagine if you don't speak the language, it's English, and you're trying to get capital from a bank, it's a huge barrier.
100%, right? And I think we also have to take into consideration the what it means from a cultural standpoint, right? In the U.S., we do business differently than we do in Latin America or in Spanish-speaking countries. Here you have to, you know, have a full understanding of making sure that your personal, you know, that your small business banker is your best friend, right? That you have that relationship with the banker, that you have an understanding of, you know, your FICO score, having a budget, how to do a business plan. All of those are, while it may sound simple, you know, for your average person, it's, you know, it is something that can be or make a difference in the experience and the success of that business. Not to mention, right, gaining access to a contract, whether it's through the city or within the state, that is going to pivot your business that much more, right? You're going to be able to scale your business because now you have access to contracts that are going to allow you to, you know, gain more, have more businesses, and then also improve.
You can join the conversation at 549-2937. You can tweet us at FCC On Air. You can email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And you can find us on Facebook and Instagram. Dr. Dominguez Carmini, I wanted to turn to you to talk a little bit about the project that you do with oral histories. So are you gathering oral histories here on the First Coast? How does that work? And how can people hear these histories? I love oral histories, probably more than I love reading histories in history books, because you actually get to hear what a person's experienced and lived, you know?
Exactly. You hear the tone of their voice, mm-hmm. the emotion. And I also take videos as well, so one can see the emotional impact of the questions or the life history that they're relaying to you and the trials, the tribulations that they went through to get here. I originally began this project in 2021. Jacksonville Historical Society approached me and asking if I could give a history, a presentation on the history of Jacksonville Hispanics, a more recent history is what they asked for. And I said, sure, I'd love to. So I went to their archives, and unfortunately, the information that I was able to access was very scant. And that being the case, I did what comes naturally to me. I'm an oral historian, so I asked them how they felt about me creating an oral history collection, and they were very, very happy, to say the least. So I embarked on this journey. I met some key individuals in the Hispanic community here, in particular, Mario de Cunto from let me see if I say this right, the Duval County Democratic Hispanic Caucus. He was one of the ones I was able to reach. And he was very interested in the project and said, yes, I'll help you. So through the snowball method, he gave me Monica Hernandez's name. And once we talked and we shared, it was instantaneous, a love affair.
Yeah.
And she was very committed as well. So between Mario and Monica, we started rolling. And the introductions came in. I followed up with phone calls, and the rest is history. Within a 3-month time period, with COVID in full force, of course.
Wow.
I did all Zoom, actually. But I was able to get 40 oral histories in a 3-month period of time, which I thought was fantastic because it was only moi was doing it.
As someone who does oral histories for a living, that's pretty fantastic. That's a lot of work in 3 months' time. What were some of the stories that you found that really moved you?
Oh, gosh. A lot of immigration stories were very telling, and the obstacles and the hardships that individuals encountered when first arriving here. They didn't speak English. They were thrust into a situation where it was either speak English or die, you know?
Yeah.
You had to really strive a lot. And for some individuals, they ended up going the wrong way at a young age because they couldn't understand the language and they just had such difficulty. And of course, some of them had been traumatized by war, by desaparecidos in their native countries. So they had a lot of trauma coming here. So they had that to deal with, plus the burden of learning the language. But they triumphed, and it's just very warming to the heart to listen to these stories and see them triumph and become successful business people, professors, leaders in the Hispanic community, and they have so much to offer then.
Yeah. We're going to go to the phones. We've got Charlie in Jack's Beach. Charlie, how are you this morning?
Hey, guys, I'm doing great. So my kids are grown, but in hindsight, if I were, you know, going to put my 4-year-old in a daycare or a school, I would try and find one, this is just my personal opinion, that spoke Spanish so that my child would be speaking Spanish all day long. And instead of just knowing one language, my child would grow up and know two. There's a saying that if you're trilingual, you speak 3 languages. If you're bilingual, you speak 2. And if you speak 1 language, you're American. So I want to try, and if I had the opportunity to do it all over again, I would put my child in a place like a daycare or a school that only spoke Spanish so that my child would grow up and be bilingual.
So are you asking where those schools are?
Oh no, I'm not. I guess I'm just
commenting.
Asking you guys, if y'all think that's a good idea, would you recommend putting your children in a school, you know, your 4-year-old or your child in a place where they only speak Spanish? Is that a good idea where they become bilingual? Because being bilingual, that gives you many, many more opportunities for positions on your resume, et cetera.
Yeah, sure. Charlie, thank you so much. I will just say that, like, I love to travel. I've been all over the world to many Latin American countries, and I can't speak a lick of Spanish. I can say hola, but that's about it. And I wish, I want to speak Spanish so badly. Like, I was in Barcelona, where they speak a mixture of Catalan and Spanish, and I was in a sea of, like, I don't know what you're saying, like, but the people were always great with me. I've had the opportunity to go to Cuba and could not speak the language. So yeah, I just to the caller's response, I think that, like, if we can all teach our children how to be bilingual, it's just so much, not even for the resume, but just to, like, connect and understand each other. Because I think that in this human experience that we're all going through, language at times is a barrier to just understanding that someone is a lot like you. Yeah. And maybe the little differences are things to be celebrated and not to be scared of. And I think if the language is not the barrier, you can begin to break that down.
Right. So sure. So Spanish is like the second most spoken language after Mandarin. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think, you know, language is definitely a connector. And to me, you know, being able to not only represent the language, but really connect with individuals from different backgrounds just makes you so much more, I wouldn't say successful, but better in your day-to-day, because we're so different, right, from different backgrounds, even if we're within from the U.S., you know, with, depending on where you're from, being able to identify, being able, that makes you a better communicator, it makes you a better you know, a better person whenever you're, you know, you're trying to get your point across.
And it's so much easier to learn a second language as a child.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. I know Duval does provide, they do have some immersion schools.
They do.
Yeah, I think to answer our caller's question is, it's important to not necessarily just go to a school where they only speak Spanish, but I think it's important just to do research on the curriculum that the schools are teaching for your toddlers. So and most of them, I'd say several are including Spanish in there already. So I think it's just important just to do your research and find out which ones are teaching.
What are the predominant Spanish nationalities or Latino nationalities in Jacksonville?
You know, there's a the Mexican community. There's a Puerto Rican community. Honduran community, mm-hmm. Guatemala, Cuban, yeah. As well. So I think I've come in contact with quite a few and.
Yeah.
And growing.
And, yeah. Growing.
And growing. Yep.
It's rapidly growing. You're going to have, you know, a lot of Venezuelans that have definitely moved into the Northeast Florida from, you know, directly from Venezuela, if not from Miami, that just continue to discover, right? I feel like Jacksonville is like this hidden gem. And as it gets rediscovered, just more communities continue to come to embrace it and really to enjoy the, you know, everything that we have here.
Yeah, yeah. Politically, when we're talking about, you know, Latinos and the Hispanic vote, I think when I think about Miami, I tend to think that specifically, like, and this is from reporting I did back in the day, that a lot of older Cubans were generally conservative and generally voted. And of course, like, you know, we're making blanket statements here, but just saying that, like, generally voted conservative and generally voted Republican, but that migrants from different countries, from Venezuela, from, you know, wherever, like, they were voting a little bit differently and sometimes a little bit more Democratic. Do we see, like, specific groups like tend to vote in one direction or has it kind of equaled out now? That's a big political question.
I think, yeah, that's a loaded question. Yeah. 100%, because you know, to be transparent, right, from a political standpoint, I do have to remain neutral,
yeah,
given as, mm-hmm, you know, our organization is a nonprofit.
I don't mean about you specifically. I'm talking about, like, the community on a whole. Do we see the community tend to, like, vote conservative? I think, like, the Black community is interesting in ways because I think at the root of it, a lot of Black people are conservative because of church values. A lot of Black folks, mm-hmm, go to, you know, and obviously these are blanket statements, but we tend to vote Democratic. And so I'm just trying to understand, you know, where that is with the Hispanic community.
I think it would depend upon the group,
yeah,
the particular group, and mm-hmm, then also the socioeconomic status that they have as well, because obviously if more of the programs that would assist, they would probably veer towards that party rather than the more conservative ones that might just not have those, what do you want to call them, net, the safety net to fall into.
And there's also the countries that they've come from and the country's experience. I think that they really, that really feeds into their decision as far as who to follow. A lot of these countries have been ruled by dictators. And so the trend to support democracy. It's getting a little bit mixed now, as far at least in terms of immigration. It used to be that the Republican Party was pretty much the major proponent of amnesty and other types of immigration reform, and a lot of the major legislature was passed under Republican presidents.
I mean, you're going back to Ronald Reagan's day, right? Because I mean, Ronald Reagan really was please correct me if I'm wrong. Ronald Reagan was the first president to really grant amnesty to migrants that had crossed. But that issue specifically in the Republican Party has now gone in a completely different way since Reagan's day.
It has, and it was. I would say it might have been overnight, just because of September 11th. And that's when you started to see the shift to what you see now. But historically, you've seen heavy border enforcement under both parties. And you have not seen a push towards immigration reform from either party, because it's just too politically loaded of an issue right now. But we're seeing a current border crisis, and politically, President Biden's the one being blamed for it. But it really is just a culmination of
right.
Congress not dealing with the issue over the past 30 years.
Yeah, I've done a lot of reporting in the Sonoran Desert in Arizona, and migrants crossing over. Specifically, the reporting that I've done have been about migrant deaths that have, people, they cross from Mexico, they go in the Sonoran Desert, they're trying to get here, and a lot of them die. And so we were doing a story about that. And that was well before Biden or Trump was in office. Mm-hmm. It was during the Bush years. And so it just feels like it's such a hot topic that keeps getting kicked down the road. And while we play political football with it, people are dying or living lives that they have to keep undercover and be quiet about.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking, the stories that I hear about the reasons that people make that trek to come here. And I've always thought, if the law were more welcoming, if the quotas were raised, if there was the ability to do it legally, people would not take such a dangerous trek to get to the United States.
I think the biggest thing when I'm thinking about these issues, after a report, like I did reporting on this for about 2 or 3 years, and I think that the thing that came to me, I'm just thinking about a heartbreaking story that I reported. I was John Fife, who was the leader of the Sanctuary Movement, who started the Sanctuary Movement. I was in the Sonoran Desert with him at a camp that he has, and the camp is there to basically make sure migrants don't die in the desert, and so they put water out and so forth. And I'll never forget this. We were talking about migrants crossing over, and I asked him, I said to him, like, I don't think the political, our political gridlock is going to change. And so if the political gridlock is not going to change, why do you keep doing this? And he pulled out a picture of a little girl, and he told me that she was crossing the desert. She got separated from the party that she was with, and she ended up dying in the desert. And she was less than a mile from his camp, but she never found it. And he said that, like, that's why he does this, because he doesn't want any more little girls to die in the desert. And it cracked my heart in two, because it's heartbreaking and senseless. And I think what I came away from that is that the issue really for me, and how it gets into our politics, like, I'm not whatever with the politicians, but the American people don't know who these migrants are, who are crossing over, and what they're coming from, and what they're going to, and how much they put on the line to actually do that.
It's so easy to to buy into the rhetoric.
Right.
Yeah.
And if they just looked at it as a human issue, which is really what it is, you know, what is driving these folks out of their countries? If the tendency is to want to be in your own country, why is this happening to where it's something that I try to relay that to folks. And I think that there's a lot happening now, like through media, where there is more and more access to those stories. But I think that is going to be the ticket to persuade people in their political views if they start looking at this issue as a human issue.
I'm curious, given Governor DeSantis's stance on immigration and migrants crossing over, have you seen an increase in clients? And just so we can reset for the listeners, Lisa Ruiz is a immigration lawyer.
Yes, it was panic this summer, starting in May when we realized that the law was going to get passed. The phone just started ringing off the hook, and potential clients alike were scared. They didn't understand. I have a lot of clients that are mixed families where we have a lot of U.S. citizens as one of the spouses. You know, does this mean I can't drive my husband around because he can't get a driver's license? Should we move? I mean, these were big fears and questions that were coming at to me and the other immigration attorneys in the area and in Florida.
And they're valid. I mean, I don't know what to say to a woman who, she's a citizen, but her husband is not. And the law says if you are transporting someone who's undocumented, that you could go to jail as well, right?
Right. It's. I had to basically analyze it as best I could legally, because all it would do is just infuriate me the way it was written. It just, to me, it just seems like it was a pure political stunt. And just kind of had a freezing effect on the amount of people coming into the state. And so I had to be able to look at it and be able to analyze it from their perspective and be able to advise them accordingly. And thankfully, it's being challenged, and it doesn't seem to be having the same effect that we were afraid it was going to have. If anything, I think there's what we're seeing is an economic effect on our state, which is also terrible. But at the same time, we're challenging the law. We're also pushing forward. And if there's anything that the immigrant community and the Hispanic community, which is a big part of the immigrant community, especially here in Florida, if there is anything that we are, it's resilient. And we're going to find ways to move forward. And yes, of course, you know, try to work within federal law as it stands now to achieve status and to bring folks legally. But at the same time, as U.S. citizens, stand up against this and call our legislators and tell us, like, this is not what we want. You are not representing our interests. There are a lot of business owners that have lost workers. We're suffering from a labor shortage. It makes no sense to me why this was passed other than for political reasons.
On that note, we're going to take a break. We are going to come back and keep going with the panel, but we will be here, and you should call in to join the conversation. But we'll be right back.
What's up? Thank you. love it.
And we are back. If you're just tuning in, we are talking about Hispanic Heritage Month. So let's dive into all the things of this great month that we've got. And we've got a beautiful panel here that we're talking about all of it. We've got Monica Hernandez, Eric Garcia. They're both from the First Coast Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. And we've got Dr. Rebecca Dominguez Carmini, an oral historian who I can't wait to listen to her project. Although, like, Dr. Carmini, I think you're going to have to translate for me because I don't speak Spanish.
Most of them are in English.
Okay. We're good then. And joining us also with the panel now is Beatrice Chandler, owner of Latin Creations. How are you, Beatrice?
I'm good. Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much. So, Monica, I wanted to talk a little bit about specifically what the First Coast Hispanic Chamber of Commerce does, like the programs you have to support Latinos who have businesses and are trying to be entrepreneurs in the Northeast East Florida area.
Absolutely. So as an organization, really, we focus in also providing education and programming that is benefiting the Hispanic business owner. So for instance, last Thursday, we had an event with, in partnership with Bank of America that it was an all-day entrepreneurship event where we had workshops that was focused on access to capital, you know, finances, how to maintain and keep a budget, how to grow your business. And also, you know, if the stage of your business is at a point where you're looking to retire, you know, what are the steps that you need to follow? So it was quite interesting and just beautiful for me. And I know for us as a board to be able to see over 130 entrepreneurs that literally showed up and were there all day from beginning to end. So the event was from 8 to 5, really focused in providing that education that really is only going to benefit the community as a whole, right? So, you know, Beatriz, she's a business owner, you know, she has a business that is ultimately giving work to, you know, 20 plus employees. And those are 20 plus families that, you know, that are benefiting from that, you know, from her business alone. So as an organization, we do focus on that. And year over year, our membership has really tripled, again, because we have seen the fast growth of the Hispanic community in Northeast Florida, because we have seen the growth in how many businesses continue to be opened. So, you know, as an organization, we not only have to make sure that we're providing those resources as, you know, such as the workshops, you know, the, you know, hosting events that are inclusive for the community at large, right? I always say that I can't preach to the choir because otherwise nothing gets changed. So we always focus in creating events that I know we're going to talk about later today that are going to invite the community at large to really learn about the stories, about the experiences, about the cultures and the contributions that the Hispanic and Latino community continue to bring forward to, you know, to the Northeast.
Beatrice, can you tell us a little bit about your business and why you started it and exactly what do you do?
Yes. So I am the owner of Latin Creations, and we've been established for 12 years. So the reason I started, I moved down to Jacksonville because all my family was here and I couldn't find a job. and
so you made one on your own.
Exactly. So I had a little bit of savings. And I told my mom, you know what, mom, you're wasting your talent, because she's the cook. She's the talent. She's the chef. She does all that great food. And we saw a niche, an opportunity to open a restaurant, because we had one back in Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. So we used that opportunity. We opened the restaurant and the community, you know, just were like, this is great. And not only the Latin community, but all of Jacksonville embraced us, and we've been very successful. And like Monica said, we are able to employ, you know, 20 employees and give them, you know, a place where they can feel secure and they can come back and you know, just give back to the community and their families as well.
Yeah. Just to be clear, let's just plug the business. Where are you at?
So we're Land Creations, 3546 St. John's Bluff. It's right by Town Center. So it's very centric, and we have great Puerto Rican food, very traditional, and a couple of other treats as well.
And you have an event coming up September 16th called the Tour of Flavors. What can you tell me about that?
Yes. That is very special to my heart. We've been working very hard. It's La Ruta del Sabor. Let's give that a spin, but Tour of Flavors. We're going to have a tasting that day. It's September 16 from 6 to 9. It's going to be, we have been able to get, we'll have food from Puerto Rico, Venezuela, Cuba, Dominican Republic, Mexico, Colombia. We even have Latin health food. Because when you think Latin food, you don't think healthy. But we got somebody who is in the chamber and provides healthy Latin food.
You are like making me so hungry right now.
Yeah. So, if you're looking to learn and diversify your palate, that's the event.
This is the opportunity. We also have beer and wine from Chile, Argentina, Brazil, Puerto Rico. So it's just like different types of food and wine that on the regular you wouldn't think, oh, wait a minute, where is this wine from?
Yeah.
You know, it's delicious, it's good, but where is it from? And apart from that, there's going to be music, art, just different things that you're going to be immersed in Latin culture altogether. And again, it's September 16th. It's at Le Jardin on Park, and it'll be 6 to 9. And your ticket will get you the tasting of all the foods and the wines.
And I'm going to be there. I wish you had brought me a plate now, because like I'm so hungry. Eric, what are you doing to celebrate Roberto Clemente's 89th birthday?
Yes, the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce is in partnership with the Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp. And with minor league baseball being extended this year, it's the final homestand for the team. And this Friday kicks off Hispanic Heritage Month. We will be in attendance there at for the game. We'll have a table to tell all the fans about what we do and how we serve the community. And we've given the Jumbo Shrimp a list of music that's important to the community and they want to listen to. So they'll be playing some good Latin music throughout the game. There'll be fireworks at the end as well. So that's coming up this Friday evening. But more importantly, it's celebrating Roberto Clemente. Hall of Fame baseball player, humanitarian, and such. So yes.
All right. We're going to come back and tell you about more events that are going on in the First Coast through this month. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Life South Community Blood Centers, providing blood and patient services to the local hospitals, serving patients in this community. Donating blood with Life South helps save lives. More at lifesouth.org to find a blood drive near you. Scenic Jacksonville presents the Great City Symposium, October 4th. A.G. Lafley, former CEO of Procter & Gamble, shares how he led the revitalization of downtown Cincinnati and the Sarasota Bay waterfront. Tickets at scenicjacksonville.com.
I'm Robin Young. One-room schoolhouses may sound like a thing of the past, but in some states, like Montana, they're a lifeline for rural communities.
You are their gym teacher, their lunch lady, besides regular academics. And it's really rewarding to watch them grow from year to year instead of saying goodbye to them after one.
The past, present, and future of one-room schoolhouses, next time, here and now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
George Floyd's murder 3 years ago sparked a movement in corporate America to highlight diversity, equity, and inclusion. But companies are now changing course. And this summer's landmark affirmative action case on college admissions by the Supreme Court is sparking new debate about what it could mean for those working in the private sector. Dialing back on DEI, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
On live radio, things don't always go according to plan.
But, I'm sorry, that's my dog.
Ooh, is that Buster? Hello, Buster.
Currently a $250,000 per account.
We should know it sounds like your dog likes to talk about the FDIC too.
I mean, Martinez, things might go to the dogs sometimes, but NPR and this station stay focused on you. Here's how to support us.
Please call 353-9528 or visit wjct.org/radio.
And we are back at it. I've got Monica Hernandez, and she is going to tell us all about all the different programs and things going on around the city for this Hispanic Heritage Month. What you got?
Absolutely. So I know we've talked about a bit already about La Ruta del Sabor and in the kickoff game with the Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimps. On the 18th, we're going to have the official kickoff for Hispanic Heritage Month, which is for Voces Hispanas. That's actually going to be at City Hall from 9 to noon. So that's an amazing opportunity for everybody within the community, Hispanic and non-Hispanic, to join us and really learn about the Hispanic voices.
Will we be able to see and hear some of the audio and video that you've collected, Dr. Karimi?
You'll be able to see the pictures, large museum exhibit style photos of the individuals and with a short bio. Unfortunately, actual voices didn't make it to this particular exhibit, but we hope to do that in the future.
But you'll be able to learn about each of the voices on our website, right? So what we're doing is that we're going to have an exhibit. So think of it as you're going to a museum and you're going to see the individual and learn a little bit about them. And then if you visit our website, fchcc.com, you're going to be able to see the details about each person and how they contributed to Northeast Florida, right? Through their business, through their profession, through their family legacy. And that's really what's beautiful about that event and about that initiative is really being able to share with the community at large about the various influences and impact that, these individuals have been, because they've been ingrained and sort of like infiltrated the community, right, in their own ways. But yet have created a legacy that have allowed us, to continue to build upon it.
Yeah.
So that's on the 18th.
And many of them will be in attendance as well.
Absolutely. So you'll get to meet them, right? And again, just going back to hearing those stories, the gentleman that called and said, that he wanted his children to learn Spanish because it creates a connection. Personally, one of the reasons why I love Hispanic voices is because we'll be able to make that connection and being able to just kind of get that firsthand experience as to who that person is, what they've built, right? Going back to, the chamber was founded 31 years ago and had, had the founders not had that vision then, we wouldn't have the organization today that just continues to impact the community and influence and be part of advocating for the Hispanic community.
What other events you got?
So we have on the 23rd, we also have a food drive that is going to be in partnership with Feeding Northeast Florida and the Jacksonville Jaguars. That is going to be from 8 to 11. Then on that same day, we also have an event in partnership with Mosh, and that is going to be an all-day family event. So great opportunity to learn, because we're also going to have a panel discussion, a mini Ruta del Sabor. So if you want to kind of taste, get a little taste of the Latin community, wonderful opportunity. And then last but not least, we're going to have the Achieving the Dream Gala. So the Starlight Gala, where we're going to celebrate and be able to award Hispanic students with scholarships. So over $22,000 in scholarships will be awarded since the inception of the program in 1998. We've been able to award over $500,000 to Hispanic students in Northeast Florida. So great opportunity. I always tell people, please get involved, right? All of our events, our big events, are in English. The only events that are typically in Spanish are the workshops, and we talked about the reason behind that. But, I want everybody to be part of this. I want everybody to get to know these business owners, to hear these stories, to understand, the diversity within the Hispanic Hispanic community. So definitely, you know, join us. If you visit at fchcc.com, you're going to see a whole wide variety of events that are available. So overall, we have six events coming up. So there is no way that you can, you know, you can miss and say, well, you know, this is a great way to kind of plug in yourself and learn more about the Hispanic community and, you know, and what it means.
All right. And that is our show today. I encourage all the listeners to check out all these events. They're going to be fun. I'm definitely coming to get some food. I'm going to all the other stuff. I want to hear the voices, but oh my goodness, my stomach is just like, feed me, Seymour, feed me. We've been talking to Monica Hernandez and Eric Garcia, the First Coast Hispanic Chamber, as well as Dr. Rebecca Dominguez Carmini, an oral historian, and Beatrice Chandler, owner of Latin Creations. They're all in the studio talking about Hispanic Heritage Month. Thank you all for coming in so much.
Thank you for having us.
All right. I'm Al Ledson. You've been listening to First Coast Connect. And that is our program. Thank you to all our guests and callers. Our executive producer is music maestro David Luckin. Our producer is Stacy the Brain Bennett. Our associate producer is Kathy Waterman. And our director, the Steven Spielberg of the operation, Brady Corum. Bam, Brady, I got it. Our theme music today is by Club De Belugas. If you have questions, comments about First Coast Connect, you can send them to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. You can also say Al's the best host ever. I mean, I wouldn't be upset about that. I'm Al Ledson, and we will see you tomorrow. And remember, everybody, keep your heart open for Duval and each other. Have a good day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.